This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is avant-garde cartoonist Art Spiegelman. He's the co-editor of Raw, an art magazine of comics and graphics. His new book is a comic that tells the story of how his Jewish parents survived the Holocaust in Poland. The comic is like a documentary about the making of the book. It shows Art in his father's house in Queens, New York. He coaxes his father to remember the war years and let him record his stories on cassette. The book has moving flashback sequences as Art's father describes passing as a Gentile, hiding out in bunkers, and facing death in a concentration camp. But at the conclusion of each of these harrowing narratives, Art's father resurfaces from the past to nag Art about something petty or yell at him for dropping cigarette ashes on the rug. Spiegelman's comic is not only about how his father survived the Holocaust, it's about how Art Spiegelman survived his claustrophobic family life in Queens. There are references to his nervous breakdown, for which he was briefly institutionalized when he was a teenager. Spiegelman draws his story as an anthropomorphic cartoon. The Jews are mice, the Nazis are cats. Spiegelman draws himself as a mouse cartoonist wearing jeans and a vest. He found the mouse metaphor appropriate to Hitler's rhetoric of extermination and his references to Jews as vermin. Art Spiegelman's book is titled Mouse, A Survivor's Tale. It's published by Pantheon.
People are usually very upset when they first hear that I've done a comic strip about the Holocaust, like just too contradictory. It's an oxymoron somewhere in there, and people just don't want to hear any more after that. But it seems to me that comics are, on the one hand, a very direct medium. They come across very viscerally. And on the other hand, they're a very, very abstract medium. You have to do a lot more work to decode a comic strip than you do in understanding a film or even in reading a book.
What kind of relationship did you have with your father when you proposed this story idea to him?
Well, actually what I should say is by proposing this story idea, I had a relationship with my father. Prior to starting the book, I was rather estranged from him. As I think becomes clear in the course of the book, it was a kind of stressful relationship at best, and I found it was just a lot easier to not get close. And it was my eagerness to know more, because although I knew some of the stories of what happened to my parents, they were dinner table conversation. I didn't really know it all, and when I wanted to know it all, I put myself back in contact with my father. And there's one thing that might actually be deceptive in this book, which is, well, I hope not, but it's possible that one could assume this is just a small aspect of my relationship with my father. Actually, the telling of the tale and me eliciting it from him was a way for my father and I to have some kind of closeness. Whenever we veered away from that subject matter, we were back in the same shark-infested waters we were always in.
When did you first become aware that your parents were survivors?
Well, I can't remember not knowing it, but on the other hand, I can't remember it ever being a significant fact. It was just one more thing that I knew about my parents. So that when I was a little kid, my mother had a tattooed number, and every once in a while, friends of mine would ask, Mrs. Spiegelman, why do you have a number tattooed on your, why do you have a number on your arm? And she would say it was a phone number she didn't want to forget or something like that. So it was built into the fabric of our life without it being a specifically pointed one. And on the other hand, a lot of their friends and therefore their friends' children were also involved in the same background. So it wasn't that anomalous.
But before you sat down and actually said to your father, tell me the story of how you survived, had he actually told you anecdotes about his survival during the war?
Well, yeah, but the same way that some other person my age's parents might have told them about life in the Depression. You know, oh, it was really hard back then. And the anecdote would just glimmer in and out between talking about taking out the garbage or doing homework.
I got the impression that you were frequently taught grim lessons about life based on your parents' experiences during the Holocaust.
Yeah, that was something I didn't know until I left home. It's true. What happened is these stories, which really haunted me, I didn't know were haunting me because they were what I was breathing. And it was only when I got some other perspective, when I went away to college and was surrounded by people who didn't have those ghosts hovering over them, that I realized there was something unusual about growing up with parents who survived a form of hell.
Can I ask you to read the two pages that serve as the introduction to Mouse? These are two pages set off from the major text of the
right,
book.
Right, they're before the first chapter. And it goes, Rego Park, New York, circa 1958. It was summer. I remember I was 10 or 11. Last one to the schoolyard's a rotten egg. I was roller skating with Howie and Steve till my skate came loose. Ow! Hey, wait up, fellas. And they run off going, rotten egg, ha ha. wait up. I go home, crying. My father was in front, fixing something. Artie, come to hold this a minute while I saw. Why do you cry, Artie? Hold better onto the wood. I fell, and my friends skated away without me. He stopped sawing. Friends? Your friends? If you lock them together in a room with no food for a week, then you could see what it is, friends.
So that was the lesson that he was trying to teach you, you know, that see who your friends really are if you were suffering without food for a week and see what they
do.
Yeah,
well, also, like, function on your own and learn what it is to be independent in that way.
Did you resist the kind of pessimism of your parents?
Not consciously. I resisted my parents. I think their pessimism I must have swallowed whole because it's still with me.
Did you have Nazi dreams when you were growing up?
Yeah. I guess one thing that haunted me when I was growing up was this one blown up photograph. It was a photograph that was originally just maybe 2 inches by 2 inches, but it was a large portrait photograph of what would have been my brother if he had survived the war. So I remember having dreams about him, although I never met him or knew much about him beyond a couple of anecdotes in that photograph. And although I don't remember them, all of them, I remember one fantasy that was recurrent was being in school, and then the principal, instead of just telling everybody good morning on the PA system, would tell all the Jewish students to go out and to the schoolyard, you know, that kind of thing.
You didn't have dreams where you were chased by Nazis?
I think I've probably had many, you know, and any older kid that I was having trouble with would immediately have a swastika on his arm, you know.
My guest is Art Spiegelman, who's the author of the new book-length comic, Mouse, which is about the Holocaust. When you approached your father and sat him down and said, you know, tell me chronologically all the details you can remember from the war and from surviving the Nazis, was it hard for him to talk about it?
Not especially. Although when I was growing up, my mother was more voluble than my father on the subject. And yet when I came back as an adult, he was rather giving of it. It wasn't a problem. And in fact, he didn't even seem to be aware of the fact that I was taping or anything till the very end. Getting it chronologically was impossible. Getting the conversation from him came in tidbits that were mosaic that had to be reassembled and worked out later. And sometimes I felt like I was playing a pinball machine and trying to avoid those penalty holes because I'd ask a question and it would fall right back into an anecdote I had before and there was no way to get out of the anecdote till I went through the entire 20-minute sequence, you know? But the way I got it from him was after I did that comic strip in 71, I went back and saw him actually even before I'd finished the comic strip while I was two-thirds through. And I showed it to him. And I told him I wanted to tape him then. For the entire 3 or 4 hour session, which was when I got the bold outlines of what's now the book, he seemed totally oblivious to the tape recorder. We were just sitting on the terrace and talking. And then at the very end, he grabbed the microphone from me and says, "And so, ladies and gentlemen, this is how it was, and I want you should know, so nothing, God forbid, like this, so many millions were killed, and it should never happen again." It was a statement for posterity, but I wasn't aware. He took me by surprise.
One of the things that really struck me in Mouse was that every time he'd finish telling you this story about narrowly surviving some horrible thing, whether it's at a prisoner of war camp or being hidden away in a bunker in somebody's cellar who was protecting him or trying to pass for Gentile, he'd come out of the story and he'd say something really petty.
Uh-huh.
You know, like criticize you for smoking or for what you were wearing or something. Can you tell the coat story?
Oh, the coat story. After my father finished telling me the story one day, I just went to get my coat to leave, and I couldn't find it. So I was kind of walking around asking my stepmother if she had seen it. She hadn't. And my father said, yeah, he knew exactly where it was. He had thrown it out. And first, I don't believe him, and I asked him to give it back, and he says it's too late. He said, when you were sitting first down to dinner, I threw it outside. By now, the garbage men took it away. Such an old, shabby coat. It's a shame my son should wear such a coat. But I like it. I offer you a warmer one. I got myself at Alexander's a new jacket, and I can give to you my old one. It's still like new. Here, just try on it. Try it on a minute. Oh, great, a Naugahyde windbreaker, and it's too big. Ah, it looks on you like $1 million. Look, Dad, you can't do this to me. I'm over 30 years old. I choose my own clothes. After you wear it a little, you'll see how good it looks. Come, I'll walk you downstairs. And then I went downstairs and kind of looked in the garbage can, and it was just buried under muck, and I couldn't believe it, but I walked home in a Naugahyde oversized jacket that I didn't like. But it was typical of what my father would do to try to arrange my life to his liking.
I kept thinking that just at the moment when you would be feeling tenderest toward your father and realizing the hell that he had survived, that he'd do something really manipulative like that, like throwing out this coat that you really love so he could give you his Naugahyde parka or something. And, I mean, how would you reconcile that? I mean, what you're supposed to do, like the way it's supposed to be, is that you find out your father's life story, all the hostilities of the past are erased, tenderness takes over, you embrace each other, you understand each other, and you reconcile.
Okay, it actually leads to a larger issue for me, which has to do with sentiment in literature, and especially in this kind of literature. It's actually one of the banes of so-called Holocaust literature, that when you're reading it, you hear violins in the background, you know, and like soft, mournful chorus sobbing. And, well, I've met some survivors who work toward that, and I've met other survivors who just are much spunkier than that in a way. And what it is I guess, this, the subject matter makes such a large claim on your sympathies to begin with that I don't think it's necessary to like underline it and push it any further than that. In fact, it kind of seems trivializing and cheap to do it that way. And my life with my father wasn't tender. My life with my father was, well, probably as ambivalent as everybody's life is with their parents, ultimately, if they dig deep and look at what it is that was going on between them. And I just wanted to make an accurate portrait of that relationship.
Your father also always complains about money, that his second wife just wants his money. She wants to rewrite his will. Everybody's out to get him. And you write in Mouse at one point, you write, "It's something that worries me about the book I'm doing. In some ways, he's just like the racist caricature of the miserly Jew." Did you ever think, oh, well, maybe I should try to present him in a more positive light?
Oh, of course. I just would never do it, but of course I'd think it. Not even just portray him, but in general, try to tailor the story to my own ideological bent or interests, and it's just too dishonest. I mean, one of the things that was important to me in Mouse is to make it all true, and that truth wouldn't be served by retouching the portraits. And on the other hand, I found that by working with the things that are actual, the book becomes far more potent, so that my father isn't a caricature of a miserly old Jew. He's a miserly old Jew. But he's not a caricature of a miserly old Jew. He happens to be Jewish. There are avaricious people of many different ethnic persuasions that I've met. And I find that working with everything that seems a problem to me when I'm first approaching it, once it's been kind of looked at from the 15 different angles necessary and assimilated into the story, it becomes a strength of what I'm working on rather than a liability. I find this a lot richer than if I had a far more exemplary father. Because if I did, then I'd have a book, maybe, whose ultimate moral would be, and if you lead a virtuous, exemplary life, then you too can survive the Holocaust. And that's not the point. The point is that everyone should have survived the Holocaust. There should never have been a Holocaust. And that kind of assumption of some kind of supernatural picking of who would survive and who wouldn't wasn't based on ethics, and it wasn't based on goodness, nor was it based on being especially evil, which is, I guess, the flip side of the way one might try to perceive somebody who comes through a situation of extremis.
You almost describe yourself as a prisoner in your home in some of your work. Did you ever feel like, oh, it's trivial to feel that you're living as a prisoner or that life is hell when you're not living through the war? This isn't really the Holocaust.
Yeah.
You know, you're living a middle-class life. You know, where is it, are you, you know, over-exaggerating or, you know, indulging yourself to feel that way?
Yes. But actually, more than that, I've gotten interested in psychological literature about children of survivors. And although most of these things that I've read, there's one book out by a woman named Helen Epstein, and then there's another book, the authors of which I can't remember, but they're psychologists who've gathered together case histories. They're stupid books, basically, and they're stupid in that they take a very small sample and try to generalize to infinity, which is unfortunate. And yet they're trying to do the same thing I'm trying to do, which is understand. And one common denominator that cropped up a number of times was children who ended up in mental hospitals or in jails. And I was in the former. And what it is referred to in the psychological literature as an anniversary reaction. It tends to happen, not always, but very often. It didn't for me, according to the literature. At approximately the same age the parents were when they got caught up in the concentration camps, the children would end up in either mental hospitals or jails. And I think that I've found a safer way of dealing with all this stuff by drawing a book, in that, you know, one of the things is you can't live through what your parents lived through, and yet you've been given this mandate to be happy because you didn't have to. And yet you're not all that happy, and then there's all kinds of ambivalences that come up from that, including a certain kind of very perverse envy of your parents having lived through something that proved that they were strong enough to live. I don't think it's a total accident that I ended up really starting work on this very long project at the age of 30, which is about the age my father was when he went into the camps. Because in order to draw Mouse, it's necessary for me to reenact every single gesture as well as every single location present in these flashbacks. The Mouse cartoonist has to do that with his Mouse parents. And the result is the parts of my story, of my father's story, that are just on tape or on transcripts, I have an overall idea and eventually I can fish it out of my head. But the parts that are in the book are now in neat little boxes. You know, I know what happened by having assimilated it that fully. And that's part of my reason for this project, in fact. And in order to do it, like I said, it's necessary for me to do a certain amount of research, photographic research, looking up drawings of survivors, a lot of readings, in order to get a sense of what it was, in order to put it in some kind of visual order for others to look at. I went back to Poland. I went to Auschwitz to look around, tried to find my parents' hometown, all part of the same kind of trying to understand and understand from the bones out what happened. And I'll say it's still not totally understandable, but it's my attempt.
You're using your art now as a way to understand your parents' experiences. When you first got involved reading comics when you were a kid, was it in a way out of your parents' house and your parents' lives, like an escape into this terrific, fantasy and...
I never thought about it that way. It probably must have been, but I never thought about it that way. The comics that I liked the best were Mad Comics, and Mad Comics sort of were a way back into reality rather than the way out. They tended to comment on and analyze what was around rather than run away from it with capes and superpowers.
They're also very cynical comics.
Yeah, so I guess it's more the pessimism that attracted me to the comics through Mad rather than the desire to escape. In fact, except for a very brief flirtation right before puberty with superhero comics, it was never of that much interest to me.
You said you gravitated toward comics that were pessimistic. What are some of the others that you
know about? I think there were a line of horror comics that were out in the 50s and war comics, also from the same publisher as Mad Comics. And actually, the way I got exposed to those is kind of funny. I'm a little too young to see to have grown up directly with the really good, juicy horror comics that brought about actually the suppression of comics in the 50s in a McCarthyite wave of fear that said comics were ruining our children. So I grew up right after comics had been made sanitary and uninteresting. My good fortune was that my father was too cheap to buy me regular comics. So he found a store right next to where he worked that sold older comics, 3 for a dime or 4 for a dime, instead of the new ones, 1 for a dime. And I think this whole wave of JD, juvenile delinquency hysteria about comics, passed him by. So he just bought me the really good stuff because it was inexpensive. And so I was exposed to what were considered rather brutalizing horror comics and some things that I still respect, which were a line of war comics that came out that were actually rather anti-war in tone.
Did you start drawing comics like that yourself?
Well, I started drawing comics myself, but not, well, like Mad more than like the others are the first things that I tried to copy, more than like the war comics or anything. I was still more interested in satire and humor, although the other comics interested me. But I would say that from about the age of 11 or 12 on, it was already, the die was cast. I was going to be a cartoonist, and that's all there was to it.
How'd your parents feel about that? And I should mention here that their first child was killed in the Holocaust, and they had you right after the war ended. And it would seem to me that there were a lot of, there's a lot of expectations of you, and that you had to serve the function not only as the second son, but as the first son too, because the first child wasn't there anymore. It was killed during the war. So, I mean, they had a lot riding on you.
There was a lot of pressure on me to become a doctor or a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And when I wasn't responding well to that pressure, they were going to settle for dentist. And they were actually rather supportive of my drawing until they saw that I was actually going to want to make a career out of this, at which point they panicked.
Did they ever try what many parents did, which is to throw out all the comics or forbid you to have more?
No,
once they realized you were serious about this?
I think
this?
They were much more tentative toward me in general than that. As a result, they sort of, with fear in their eyes, allowed me to more or less go ahead. The only deal that was struck was that I would have to go to college. I was a very good student, so it wasn't a problem. It's just my interests were taking me somewhere else.
My guest is Art Spiegelman, who is the author of the new book, Maus, which is a book-length comic about the Holocaust. When did you first start seeing the first signs of underground comics?
Well, actually, when I was still in high school, I went to the just-started East Village Other in New York City. I saw that they had some very bad cartoons in their first couple of issues, and I wanted to go down and get published there because I was just looking to get published. And, in fact, a number of the underground cartoonists I met later were actually in circumstances similar to mine. It wasn't that they were specifically involved with the underground press, except they wanted to be cartoonists, and that was their... That was a place to breathe and actually publish. Underground comics, especially after their first surge of activity, broadened in their themes and in the content of what would happen in an underground comic. But in people's minds, by the time that happened, which was in the, say, 71, 72, underground comics were already typecast as being about sex and drugs, and so it was very hard for somebody who might be interested in something else to even find it, you know? The underground comics represent something, though, which is the beginning of, I think, something that's beginning to flower now, which is it was the first time there was such a thing as an avant-garde for comics. Comics history is such that the first comics in America were born for a very specific reason, which was to sell newspapers. And they did a very admirable job of selling newspapers by entertaining people enough to want to come back and see more of that character or that story the next day. Then comic books, which would be the next evolutionary phase, which is longer comic stories gathered together rather than just daily installments, were basically a kind of cheap pulp fiction and weren't, for the most part, dealing with serious themes seriously. And the cartoonists who worked on that kind of comic book did it to earn a living. It wasn't a glamorous profession. It was a blue-collar profession, being a comic book artist, three steps lower than being an illustrator, one step higher than being a shopkeeper, perhaps, or maybe not even. And yet with underground comics, you have for the first time a generation of artists who'd grown up reading comics, admiring and liking them, wanting to do them, and were here doing them not specifically for financial gain, but because that was the way they wanted to express themselves. And that led to a different kind of comic than had ever existed before. And I would say that Maus is certainly an outgrowth of that, and there are many, many others now.
Have you ever done commercial work either to, you know, make ends meet financially or to...
A lot.
Just, you know, learn technical
sure.
stuff?
Sure. For a number of years, I worked for Playboy as a comic strip artist. I've done illustrations for the New York Times, for Women's Wear Daily, for a number of European publications. Typical New York freelance illustrator's beat. And then one thing that I'd done from the age of 18 on was I worked for a bubblegum company, and I'm still involved with them. So over the years, I've worked in many different capacities, ranging from, I've done art direction for them. I've done writing and editing. I've done illustration for them. I've come up with new product ideas for them.
Have you ever done those tattoos that you lick your arm and you
oh,
put
sure.
the tattoo
I've
on?
I've worked on those. I've even written comic strips for Bazooka Joe on occasion.
Really?
But among the more interesting ones maybe are, do you remember something called Wacky Packs?
Yeah.
They were like parodies of products like Toad detergent for cleaning your pet frog instead of Tide detergent, and their little stickers. Well, I was responsible for that, and I've been there's one product that came out that was mine, which was called Garbage Candy.
Oh,
which was,
yeah.
plastic garbage can
yeah,
with candy
those.
In the shape of garbage inside.
Yeah. It was kind of on the same theme as the mummy candies.
Yeah, exactly.
Those?
Yeah.
That was yours,
yes.
too? Oh, I should buy those and give them out to my Egyptologist friends. I really did.
So I've just been involved over the years with a number of candy novelties, basically, as a way of making ends meet.
So you've really lived in both worlds.
Yeah, my problem was that I couldn't do the kind of comics I wanted in the places that wanted me to do comics or illustrations. The needs of Playboy necessitated that the kind of comic strip I did, even though it wasn't something I was ashamed of, wasn't something I was necessarily interested in. And Playboy wasn't able to give the same kind of freedom to their cartoonists that they gave to Vladimir Nabokov or Norman Mailer when they printed their fiction. And that was the freedom I demanded.
What's kept you in the comic form? Because I'd imagine it's hard to reach a large literary and art audience through comics, because not that many people know about this kind of work.
Yeah, I think that may change and is changing. But what keeps me there is the fact that the form itself is very, very exciting to me. And what's most exciting is the fact that its potential hasn't even been scratched away at. And when I was just giving you this brief outline of the history, it's only since the 60s that cartoonists even began to just say, well, we'll write whatever we want to write and do whatever kind of comics we want to make. Film and literature had that freedom in a sense. An avant-garde tradition in film goes back almost to the very beginning of film. Literature, except for bestseller kind of literature, potboilers always had that freedom to explore the artist's sensibility, the world around the artist. Since it hasn't been part of what comics were all about, and since comics have a fairly sophisticated vocabulary, it's exciting to work things out through the comics medium for me. There's things that can happen in comics that just can't happen any other way. For instance?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. It has a directness, I'm sorry to use the word again, that isn't available in any other form. For instance, if you're a writer, your writing gets set in type. And type is a cold, mechanical thing. And a writer like James Joyce and like Jacqueline Suzanne might both be set in the same typeface. Comic strips are a form of handwriting. And what could be more personal and intimate than a handwriting? In fact, it's sometimes by some people used as an analytic tool to discover something about the personality. Comics have something in common with film. And yet, unlike film, a comic strip can be made by one person. And to me, at its best, it often is made by one person. A film is, by definition, a group activity. And by being a group activity, it's not as pure an expression of an individual psyche. And therefore, although I love films, it would be less attractive for me to work in film. I also find the comics have a lot in common with music, but that might be a little harder to explain. It has something to do with the rhythms that are set up by the sizes of boxes. And as a result, I find that there's just so many possibilities. By combining words and pictures unselfconsciously, one can set up symphonic effects.
That was cartoonist Art Spiegelman. His new book, Mouse, A Survivor's Tale, is published by Pantheon. Spiegelman co-edits the comics and graphics magazine Raw. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Joyce Lieberman. The interview was edited by Maeve McGoran. Production assistance from Marty Moss Cohen. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I produce the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview, or for a listing of other programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4802. That number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.